and I'm going to interview him on a few questions. The interview is taking place in the living room in a comfortable setting, and it should prove to be a rewarding interview. I'll ask you now, Dad, a few questions, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Of the three manufacturing plants you worked at, the Monroe Auto Equipment, Chrysler Corporation, and Ford Motor Company, which one seemed the most rewarding and which did you enjoy the most?
I enjoyed working at the auto company most. It was more of a family company there. It wasn't large. And I knew most of the fellows I worked with. I went to school with them before. So it wasn't hard to work there when you knew everybody. Being a smaller company, people were naturally closer.
Yeah. Well, you ended up retiring at Ford's this past year. How did you enjoy Ford Motor Company?
Well, I enjoyed working for Ford. A much larger company, had larger and better equipment to work with. A lot of people I never did know their first name, but I had recognized them on the street. It's just something that the plant is so noisy, you don't talk too much to the people.
Right.
Mostly sign language, and sometimes you'll know a man for 25 years, not even know his
And really see him every day, but not actually
know his name. Like if you were going to introduce him to someone, you wouldn't know his entire name.
That's interesting. Okay, in the early years in Monroe and Ida, where you lived, was a lot of work expected of you by your parents?
Oh, yes, because we worked on a farm, and my father worked as a millwright at the River Raisin Paper Company in Monroe, and he was gone 12 or 15 hours a day, so between the both of us, we farmed the farm.
Well, what were some jobs that were expected of you on the farm?
Well, I did a man's work on the farm. I worked a team of horses, and I dug ditches, and I dug potatoes, and I fetched hay, and fetched corn, and really worked hard.
Yeah.
We always had quite a few steers we fed through the winter, so the chores didn't slow up in the wintertime, they picked up.
Okay, if you did have any free time, how did you spend this free time when you didn't have to work on the farm?
Well, I'd either take my bicycle or my Model T Ford and I'd ride into Ida and see what the big town looked like and see some of the kids I went to school with during the day. We didn't have too much money for gasoline, so we didn't go too far.
Yeah, that's how it is today, too. Okay. You spent much of your early life in the midst of the Great Depression. How did this affect you and your family?
Well, we watched every penny that we could get our fingers on. And I guess it carries right on up to the present time.
Yeah.
And my kids never could understand why I wanted them to eat everything on their plate, but it's just a carryover because there were times during the Depression where, through no fault of our parents, we didn't have enough to eat sometimes. And what there was, you ate, but you ate it all. You didn't throw any away.
Well, what was a common food that you ate a lot in the Depression that wasn't real expensive, yet was fairly readily available to you and your family?
Mostly cornmeal. We had it fried, boiled, fried again. And didn't taste good raw. And small potatoes that the farmers couldn't sell to anybody else. Well, we ate those small potatoes. They fed them both the pigs and the people.
Okay. Of all the holidays you've seen in your lifetime, is there any that stand out in your mind as being most memorable?
Well, usually the 4th of July stood out as the main one because it was right in the middle of the summer. And if we got all our wheat, when we were on the farm, if we got all our wheat cut and shocked, by midnight, the 3rd of July, I could have the 4th of July off. Otherwise, we worked in the grain field until we got all the grain taken care of first. Then if there was any 4th of July left, I could have that much.
Well, how did you spend the 4th of July? Why was it so memorable? memorable to you?
Because in Ida they would have a 4th of July celebration. And they didn't have the firemen's picnic started yet, but there would be maybe a traveling show would come into town and set up right down next to Main Street, and we'd all go there and watch it. Free show.
Right. Jack, or Dad, I should say, how did you and your family come to settle in Monroe from Fremont, Michigan?
Well, we lived on a farm in Fremont, Michigan, and all of the main buildings on our farm burned early one spring. And during that same time, the farm right directly across the road from us was sold to a former sheriff of Monroe County, a fellow by the name of Ed Vassard. He was retired, so he retired there up there on that farm, and he asked my dad if they were going to rebuild the buildings, and my dad said no, they weren't insured. So he says, well, if you're looking for a job, the little town of Monroe, Michigan that I just moved from has a lot of work there. They have three paper mills and all different sized plants, different industry there. It's an awful good town to find a job in. So my dad went down there and worked a year. He would come home periodically, but the rest of the family stayed up on the farm. So we finally sold our farm, and we all moved to Monroe. That was in 1921.
Mm-hmm. Well, why did you move from Monroe to Ida while you were still in school?
Well, about that time the Depression came along, and my father didn't have a job. No one had a job. And we were just renting a home in Monroe, and the rent was so high we couldn't afford to pay it. So we moved into a house in Ida that is no longer there, and I think we paid $8 a month rent.
Mm-hmm.
And my father picked up jobs around for different farmers. And then he more or less got a steady job until he was working for a farmer in Petersburg by the name of Zell McCarty. And he was real good to my dad, and he would usually pay him off in farm produce, like potatoes and stuff like that, that mm-hmm. he could bring home and we could eat. Then as times picked up a little bit, well, my dad bought a farm out here, and with the help of his sister, and then the plants reopened in Monroe. He went back to work there and paid his sister off for what she'd helped him pay for the farm.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why we came to Ida.
I see. Let's see. Of all the presidents that you've seen in your lifetime, who do you feel was the best and the worst, and why?
Well, I kind of liked Eisenhower myself because I soldiered under him for 4 years or a little better, and he was pretty fair square fellow there. And a lot of people won't agree with this, but I never could understand why they thought Franklin D. Roosevelt was such a great president, because he is the man that instituted the first federal income tax,
mm-hmm.
and it was supposed to be temporary, and it's still with us.
Okay, how do you feel about Ronald Reagan?
Well, I think he figured he had a lot of simple solutions for some of the problems we've got that are turning out not to be so simple. Because when you want to change government around a little bit, there's every little nitshit politician that has got his own little sphere he operates in, and he doesn't want anybody shaking him loose from it. So naturally, he won't give anybody any support that is going to threaten him.
Right.
And I think that's most of Reagan's problem right now, is politicians that don't want to give up with the common people. And they will resist him on every move, because it will affect them, their money into things. If you get them all to pull together, well, we could probably pull out of this pretty easily, but Everybody blames the automobile companies for the recession, and they actually constitute only 5.1% of the entire workforce in the United States.
Hmm.
So how can you blame them?
Right. You were involved in World War II. Can you explain how you felt when you first encountered the Germans?
Well, I wasn't exactly mad at them right at the moment, until one of them shot at me. And then I figured, well, goddamn, he's trying to kill me. And it scared me at first, and then it made me mad. So I guess I stayed mad all the way through Europe.
Yeah, I can see how I'd be mad, too, if someone was shooting at me.
I didn't realize what was happening at first time I got shot at. And it got to me pretty quick.
You learn quick, eh?
Well, like they used to teach us in school, self-preservation is foremost in every man's mind. And it was.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain some of the significant battles that you were involved in?
Well, I can't explain them. But I'd a lot rather been some other place.
Yeah.
But it just happened that the military strategy was such that we got stuck in a few of them, like the battles in the hedgerows in France. And we had never fought in the hedgerows before.
Right.
So about the only thing we could do was take our tanks, that were equipped with bulldozer blades, and bulldoze holes in the hedgerows. Instead of climbing over them, we walked through them. And these were all preset German positions in there. And we didn't exactly know where they were at first, but as the fighting progressed, we found out where they were to expect them and where not to expect them. So we guided ourselves accordingly. And then later on, there's different little battles, and we came to the Battle of the Bulge. That was the last main push of the German army, but it got pretty rough, and it was pretty cold. It was about, I'd say, 20 below zero for about 6 straight weeks, and we had about 3 or 4 feet of snow on the level. And no place to go at night, or in the daytime, except into the snow. And it got to be pretty rough, but that was the last really organized German resistance on any large scale. After that, why, it was more or less how much territory you could take per day.
Right. It was true that in World War II, Hitler had a lot of concentration camps in Germany and in Poland and in the countries surrounding Germany. Did you ever encounter any of these concentration camps near the end of the war?
Oh, yeah. Yes, we found the camps where he held strictly poorly slave laborers and where they had been annihilating the Jews. And the way it looked to me, annihilating about anybody they get their hands on.
Mm-hmm.
You knew the camps, you were coming to them because you could smell them for 3 to 5 miles before you got to them. There were so many dead people there. It was rotten. When those German people tell you they didn't know what was going on, they're damn liars.
So, once you were inside the camps, were they as gruesome as history has told us they
Every
were?
Every bit as gruesome, sometimes worse.
What did you see inside these camps?
Well, it's not pleasant to remember. It's just starvation, where they march the people through the gas chambers. You see a pile of dental plates and partial plates 4 feet high that they took out of their mouth before they went through there. And all the rings and valuables and clothes, they stripped them of clothes completely, and they never came out the other end except when they were dead. So what they couldn't burn in the oven, the ovens were still full of bones, but they couldn't burn in the ovens, they had put into railroad boxcars and were trying to ship them out of there before the Allies got there. But we got there quicker than they'd expected, so the whole thing was right there before us.
Mm-hmm.
It's no lie about that. It was awful.
Yeah. Can you describe what you did and how you felt when you heard the war was over?
Oh, boy, I felt like I felt like I was about 20 pounds lighter.
Responsibility seemed to get a little bit lighter after
Oh yeah, I wanted to go home right then.
Can you remember if you celebrated at all, or if you just kind of were glad among yourself that,
well,
that the war
was
done?
It was pretty close to midnight at night, and I heard a truck come down the street where we were. We were in a holding position on the Czechoslovakian border, and we were about to meet the Russian army. We were 70 kilometers right straight south of Berlin, and this truck came down the street after dark and had his headlights on. So I hollered out to my corporal of the guard and told him to get down there and tell that damn fool to turn his lights off. And about that time, there was an awful artillery barrage cut loose from our guns. And, you know, nobody could hear themselves think for a little bit. We were in this big town. And so the corporal came back to me and told me that the fellow's nuts. He said the war was over. That's why I had his lights on. And he gave me a big bottle of cognac, and here it is. So I went down to see really what was going on, and I guess it was so. Boy, there was stuck to the lights, skyline along there, coming along there with the lights on.
Mm-hmm.
So we took the bottle of stuff upstairs and drank it, had a good time.
Mm.
Then the next morning, we all wanted to go home right now.
Yeah.
And they said, no, it's going to take a while.
Yeah, can you explain? I remember in a previous conversation we had a couple of years ago about you saying that you got into some type of camp just before you left Europe, and it was like an allies camp that you could stay in until you went to the mainland of the United States, but
yeah,
they treated you bad or something.
Well, yeah, when the war was over, there weren't too many of us fellas left. And we didn't have any officers, so a tank destroyer captain took what trucks and tanks we had and used them, and we were just there for rations and quarters, no duty with him.
Mm-hmm.
He said he'd arrange it so we could return to the United States. So he made arrangements with the TUSA, that's the European Theater of Operations, USA.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Eisenhower's command, and get us transferred to the States. And there was just 11 of us original fellas left, so there was no more transportation left in Europe, no railroad lines left, and the fellow from Detroit and I hooked a ride. We got our travel orders finally, report to the United States of America, the means of conveyance, anything government. So we went down to a Air Transport Command base in where'd they have these trials?
Nuremberg.
Yeah. Nuremberg, Germany, and we talked with a captain there, and so we got onto the flight manifest list, flying from Nuremberg to England. And we took off from there, and we just bummed a ride, in other words, and in a C-47, and we landed in France just for a little bit outside Paris, and then we ran a Croydon Aerodrome in England, outside London. So we caught a truck about 6 miles, and then they told us there was a replacement depot there where we could probably get, you know, a meal and a couple meals and could stay overnight, sleep in the bed. So
mm-hmm.
we turned ourselves in at the 10th Replacement Depot. And I noticed it looked like a big army stockade that had barbed wire over the top of the fence. And I asked one of the fellas, I said, hey, are we in the wrong place here? And he says, no, but he says, if you can possibly get out of here, get, because he says, this colonel we've got here, his name was Colonel Killian. He says he's got a bunch of non-coms here, and he says they're kind of I don't know what the word is, but they would beat the American fellows that were in there, and they would put them in the guardhouse at the least provocation. And So I talked it over with my buddy, and we went over the fence that night after dark. We ate supper, and registered with our bunks and everything. As soon as it got dark, we left. And we hitchhiked into London, and we slept in a tube that's the underground, the subway.
Right.
That night, and the next morning early, we went up to the train station, and there was a, we learned there was a air transport command base up in Prestwick, Scotland, that was flying back to the States. So we bummed a ride on this Royal Scot train. We didn't have any money, and we rode in the engine with the fireman and the engineer. Big red train, pinstripes and gold on it, I'll never forget it.
Hmm.
And we went up to Glasgow, Scotland. And then we got off there and we hitchhiked out to Prestwick base. And we got on a manifest list there. Well, it was a little hanky-pank in, but we made the list. And it took us 25 and a half hours to fly back to Washington, D.C. International Airport from there.
Right.
It took us 21 and a half days to get over there by ship, and I didn't want any more of that.
And when was this, when you were put into combat at the beginning of the war? It took 21 days?
Yeah. We left in Boston, Massachusetts, Boston Harbor. But you had to zigzag across the ocean because the German submarine packs were running in.
Mm-hmm.
And we went way up by Nova Scotia and Newfoundland, then we'd cut back again, and we would change course so radically that one time the water would be warm and it'd get hot in the ship. Maybe the next week it'd be ice cold, it'd be northernmost. And we finally put in a real dense fog up between England and Ireland. We put in at Ireland
mm-hmm.
for a while, and then we came back out of there and went on to Southampton, England. That's where we landed.
I see. We recently discussed in history class how an individual had been gunned down on his porch in Monroe. Can you explain how you witnessed this and possibly why the underworld wanted this individual dead?
Well, we at that time, we hadn't been in Monroe too long, and we lived on the north side of the river on East Elm Street. And I wanted some roller skates, so my dad, after he got home from working day shift with the River Raid Paper Company, he walked across the bridge and went over to, we're going over to a hardware store, St. Charles Hardware it was, in the East End. And it was, by the time we walked over there, why it was starting to get a little dark, it was after supper and everything.
Mm-hmm.
We, when we went in the hardware store, a big old black car went by us, heading down into Lower East End. It had side curtains on it, closed, so you couldn't see who was in it. I thought it was kind of funny because it was right in the middle of summertime.
What is a side curtain?
Well, the cars then didn't have any glass in the doors. You cranked up.
Mm.
They had curtains you snapped on when the weather got bad, when it got rainy or something. They snapped on there. They made some stuff called icing glass. It's a flexible plastic material.
I see.
Anyway, that car went by, and we didn't pay too much attention to it. We went into the hardware, and we went there maybe, it didn't seem to be over 3-4 minutes, and it sounded like a bunch of heavy firecrackers going on, more like dynamite, right around the corner from the hardware. And pretty soon we heard an engine racing like that, big car, sounded like a truck at first, and it went racing back across the river, across the bridge.
Right.
Well, we just stepped to the front of the store, and so did Mr. St. Charles, the owner, who was buying the roller skates. Looked out the window, big front window of the hardware, and you see the same big black car going back across the river. And it had the side curtains off on one section of the one side. And we found later that they had went down the corner and turned, and this fellow was on his front porch in a rocking chair, and his house sat right on the corner. They just come by in front of his house and turned the corner. Just they turned the corner, I guess about four of them, a shotgun, blew him right off his front porch, chair and all. And evidently it had something to do with, well, like you say nowadays, organized crime in Detroit, because Monroe was halfway between Detroit and Toledo, and the gang in Detroit they call the Black Hand Gang and the Purple Gang were in there, and they were in Toledo too. So whenever any of them had any hiding to do or anything, they used to hide out in Monroe. Well, evidently this fellow had something to do with the liquor end of it, you know, the hijacking and rum running. And see, a lot of those prominent people in Monroe, that's the way they got their start. They bootlegged it. And it was during Prohibition. There was big money bringing in liquor from Canada. They're being by boat and car and anything they could do. And then they used to fly a few Chinese in there by plane. And I that's what I figure it was. It was, you know, it never came on the paper what it really was.
Mm-hmm.
And every now and then, we were little kids, and we ran onto a dead man over in the alfalfa field one time. He never was identified.
Yeah.
He had the ends of his fingers cut off, acid poured in his face, wire on his neck, all the labels tore out of his suit. He was laying on his back, hands folded on his chest.
So no one could ever identify him, huh?
Never did find out who he was.
Huh.
But we were walking behind the mowing machine, and the old fellow worked for the River Aid Paper Company. They had horses all over, and they'd pull their waste wagons down to the dump and from the beaters. And he was mowing alfalfa, and he told us kids we could follow him if we'd stay behind his mowing blades. We stayed backing up, but the horses stopped, and they wouldn't go ahead. He tried to get him to go ahead, either one side or the other. So we thought there was a bee's nest there, so he got off and walked up there in front of the horses to see what it was, and us kids come up there too, and there was a dead man laying there right off in the alfalfa field. Well, they'd find him floating in the water and in the marsh, and they just, you know, between Detroit and they just kill him and dump him off.
Well, can you explain how all the bootlegging that's famous for Monroe went on without the authorities ever catching any of these guys, how they got away with it?
Well, usually the authorities ran on it too with the men. And evidently they were paying them off. There wasn't much problem.
Yeah.
The Coast Guard and the revenue fellows would have big white Coast Guard cutters out in Lake Erie, and they would catch them, but they had fast speedboats.
The bootleggers did, or the Coast Guard did?
The bootleggers. It would outrun the Coast Guard cutter. But the Coast Guards would machine gun them if they got close enough. Nights, you know, in the hot summertime, you'd hear firing out there on the lake. Well, you never knew what they were doing, but best not to get tangled up in it.
Yeah, I can see that.
But moonshine was, or good Canadian bottled whiskey was available anywhere in Monroe at any time. There's no problem getting it.
Yeah. Well, do you know how there's been a lot of talk of the Canadian whiskey coming from Canada in the wintertime? Do you know if they would come over the...
Come across the ice.
Come across the ice.
With cars.
And the authorities, like say the FBI or anything, never, the federal agents never came in and tried to stop them?
Sure, they caught some of them, but the local officials are, say the least, very lax.
Well, in all your years, can you say, Dad, who the most influential personality in your life was, or who you looked up to most?
No, I can't think of anyone in particular. I always try to look at both sides of the question, both sides of the person, and you get the good and bad both there, so none of them are shining examples.
Well, did if you were to have to, I don't want to put you on the spot or anything, but have to pick one out, would it be someone like your father or an uncle maybe or a sister or...
Well, my dad always tried to steer me, keep me out of trouble and so forth. And Mom always gave us a real good home life, so it... Your parents spent a lot in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And they had more of a control over it. Because you couldn't get very far from home unless you walked.
You can't walk too far, though. Okay, I appreciate the interview, Dad, and thanks a lot.
Sure.
This concludes the tape. Thank you.